great designation with regard to our technological age that I stumbled across maybe 6, 7, 8 years ago, in which they describe some people as being digital natives. That's everybody that's in my young adult class. That's everybody that's been born any time after the 80s, I guess, where we've had cell phones, we've had computers, you know, ever since that time. Then they are digital natives. They grew up with all of this technology. They've never known a time without it. Digital immigrants are people like myself and most of you who moved into that territory. And so we live much of our lives without those tools and have learned to work with them to varying degrees. And then, so I'm a digital immigrant. And then there are those who are digital tourists. Every once in a while, at a friend's house, they might make a foray over to a computer in a library or something, and see what the internet looks like. And so not really familiar with it. I bring it up tonight because there are, I think, biblical tourists and then biblical immigrants. Today, of course, there's no such thing as a biblical native. We don't live in the biblical times and we don't live in the biblical places. And so we can't have, a lifelong association with those things in that sense. But every human being has to make the choice as to whether or not they're really going to be a Bible student or just a biblical tourist. Once a week, they go on a little, side trip, a little day jaunt, into the world of the Bible. Or if you're going to try to live there day by day, every day. Bible study is the thing that biblical immigrants do. It is people who want to live in the Bible. We're trying to understand it fully and completely. We want to spend as much time there as we possibly can. And so, as I mentioned last week, and we'll be doing that this week and for the next several weeks, as the debate is approaching, I'm going to particularly be abusing both the biblical tourists among us, as well as the biblical immigrants, as we're going to do just mostly a lot of reading and just looking at the passages and letting us stew on them. Won't have time for all these passages, nor even time to try and develop, the tenth part of them probably in the very little time that we'll have in the debate. But for the congregation here, for you and for me, I trust it'll be very valuable for us to see everything or most of the things that God has said about the topic of the Sabbath, which we started with last week, and then whether or not there's a contemporary revelation, which we'll get to a few weeks from now. With a view to trying to tie that in then visually as best we can, I think this is probably the best ever photograph that I've been able to find of the Sinai Peninsula. I'm going to look at a bunch of other maps here for just a minute, but as you look at this one, to this side off the screen, of course, is Egypt. This is our triangular Sinai Peninsula. And on this side, you've got the Arabian Peninsula. The events of the Exodus take place starting just off screen right here and then coming across and filling this land in 40 years of movement that is impossible for us to really trace with arrows like I'm going to try to do now. All I'm saying is that the actual route that was taken, very difficult to identify. Quite a number of different locations are given, but those locations after 3,500 years are long since, lost to mankind. We have no idea where those cities are now. Every so often, some will be discovered or some evidence will be discovered. That's great. That's wonderful. We talked about some of that stuff in the Exodus movie that we've been mentioning. It was out last night. But, by and large, it's just too far back, and the circumstances are just entirely too harsh in this awful desert for anything to remain behind after all these centuries and millennia. But in some pathway, the Jews came out of Egypt, went straight across over the borderlands, the Dead Sea right here, and then failed in their faith. God had 12 spies go out, look at the land, it was magnificent, but the people were big and well fortified. And so we can't take these cities, we can't handle these people. 10 of the 12, showed the lack of faith. Now only Joshua and Caleb said, follow me, boys, we can take them. But that wasn't enough. And so the Lord punished the people with 40 years wandering around in this area. Again, we don't know where they went. But apparently, at some point, they were down in this general region right here, which, from this marvelous graphic, you can tell, is again a triangular mountainous region that's in the southern third of the Sinai Peninsula. Somewhere in here, there is a mountain where God spoke to Moses. And when he did, the people were terrified, even though they had been told to stand at a distance and that they would die if they didn't. They heard this exchange. It horrified and terrified them. They swore allegiance to their God, but they pleaded with God, "Don't ever talk to us again. Talk to Moses. It is just too frightening to be in your presence." So, then they marched out of that area on some unknown pathway, came up right at the tip there, you know, they went around the Dead Sea, and then would march in from the northern shore, northern side of it, and to head westbound, you know, come into their promised land. Now, if we were to step back and look at just, you know, a typical map right here, here's the area that we're talking about. Iran, and I hope you can see these black borders, you know, is a vast reach of the Arabian, Iran is to the east of the Arabian Peninsula. It is, as you can see, just gargantuan territory. Iraq, who is perpetually at war with Iran, two of them can't get along, despite the fact that both Muslim nations, you know, they're constantly lobbing missiles at each other, is also an enormous territory that we hear about in the news every day. Syria is only a little bit smaller than Iraq right there. Turkey is ginormous, again, stretching from here to here, you know, into the two waters. And again, both Islamic nations. And then Egypt, another Islamic nation, predominantly, comprise the kind of big players in what we call the Middle East today, in all the terrible troubles that have been going on, you know, for just the longest time. Saudi Arabia, of course, we've already identified, is about the same size as Iran, I guess. Maybe Iran's a bit bigger. And then down here is Yemen. You've been watching the news. You know, it's a big thing. Just yesterday, the presidential palace, which the American people, through our government, whether you like it or not, you know, it doesn't matter, but the government is supporting them, backing them, and they've been helping us a little bit in our fight against these various Islamic terrorist groups. Well, the president's having a tough time staying in office today. It's the big story of the day, whether or not Yemen will fall to the rebels and become, you know, wholly owned by people that just have no fondness for us whatsoever. That's just another part of the Arabian Peninsula. What we're getting to is that area right there. And what I wanted you to see is, you know, that these are real places that still exist with peoples that are the direct descendants of the ones that biblical characters interacted with. And that for all the, you know, ginormous size of these other countries, which makes this peninsula look really small, it's really not all that small. If we zoom in the area that I've bordered out right there, you know, you can just see a little bit more clearly those borders. But this is the place where God decided that he wanted to put his people in their chosen land. Israel's northern border is right there. It comes down to this sharp, you know, V-point right here. We've got this little port there. And then carved out of it today is what we know of as the West Bank. It is the Palestinian area within, as you can see, right out of the middle there, really, of the Israeli territories of today. And then zooming in one more time, but switching to a different map, here's a nice straight border, another straight border, and that 90-degree corner right there, and then the waters, marks off what is Egypt today. A lower Egypt, downstream, you know, an upper Egypt, fabulous Nile River. It's just a wonder of the world there, of course. And then, zooming in one more time, you will see that that peninsula is about 260 miles from top to bottom if you go from Gaza to its furthest little pinnacle point. And then, not having any idea how I was going to measure it from side to side, it's just kind of very arbitrarily doing so, I picked this body of water right here and measured across then to the Dead Sea, and there's about 182 miles right there. Now, the movie, if you went to see it, and again, it was a good thing to see. It was not, you know, something like saying it was just, you know, really powerful and dramatic and aha, but it really was enlightening, it was helpful, that is suggesting that this city, Avaris, right here, is likely the city in the area of Goshen, where we do have some traces of Semitic peoples back in that time frame. And so they would have been making this journey out of there, crossing over the water, and then going straight up to these borders somewhere, and then headed down into all this wandering, eventually coming back up again. If you got 260 miles by 180, you got a pretty big area. You have a very desolate area. You have a people who must depend entirely upon their God for their food and for their water, as they have not a long history there. They've just walked out of town and into a desert. It is a miracle that they survived, that they were able to endure and survive these 40 years, and then come back through all of this territory. Now you've added up an awful lot of miles to make their entrance into that promised land. Here is the final map we'll be looking at today, and again, the southern third of the Sinai Peninsula, and right there is Jebel Musa, the mountain of Moses, and this little triangle represents what is the traditional site for the events that took place last week, as we were reading in Exodus chapter 16, and again in 19 through 20. So there's the territory, somewhere down in the worst of it, in the most jumbled part of it, in the steepest and hardest part of it, God made himself known to these people. David Roberts was an explorer, an adventurer, and an artist who, in the 1800s, traveled extensively in Bible lands with a commission to do so. He was paid, you know, by some government, British, I think it was, to get over there. And this is from July 17th of 1839, a drawing that he made while he was there in that area, approaching what is that traditional site of Mount Sinai. So that's about as far back as you could go with any sort of an eyewitness representation of what it looked like. And I think it's just very helpful there because, again, as I pointed out last week, there are large areas that are rather flat and sandy where people and livestock, you know, could be more comfortable and could bed down for the night, who could camp for quite a while. And then there was some amazing peak which Moses climbed at least five times, upon which he fasted for some 40 days, and received from the hand of God himself these tablets. Now, I might point out that Lee Carter and Carol there had purchased a book, which I stole out of the library about 6 months ago and haven't returned yet, that is the collection of these drawings by David Roberts. One of these days I'm hoping to put together a lesson that will employ nothing but the artistry of this David Roberts and do, you know, a lesson that will help visually, again, to help us become immigrants, people that live in the Bible, people that have as accurate a picture in our minds as can be of what it was to be those people. But when all is said and done, on the location and you know, and on the elevations and that sort of a thing, all that matters is what the Scriptures really say about how we are to conduct our affairs. There are Seventh-day churches. Some are Baptist, some are Pentecostal, and the most prominent are the Seventh-day Adventists, who teach that the Sabbath revealed on that mountain in that awful desert must be kept today. That it is incumbent upon all breathing human beings since creation to keep that Sabbath. If you don't, you're in trouble with God. In that, regardless of the sacrifice of Christ on the cross, that Sabbath, which was so much a prominent part of the old law, was never done away. It is to be kept today. We looked at definitions last week. Nelson's Illustrated Bible Dictionary says that it is the practice of observing one day in seven as a time for rest and worship. I put it out last week. The "and worship" stuff cannot be found in the Scriptures. They were not commanded to assemble on that day. No one was ever commanded to assemble on that day. Nobody was ever commanded to worship on that day. They were commanded to rest. We'll be discussing then that definition, how this idea of worship crept into it, you know, quite possibly in the course of the debate. It's not a biblical idea at all. Again, this time from Unger's Bible Dictionary, I have several definitions for it that you can go into that we'll review, but they say it means repose, cessation from exertion. The name Sabbath is applied to various great festivals, and that's what we'll be studying this evening. But principally and usually to the seventh day of the week, the strict observance of which is enforced not merely in the general Mosaic Code, but also in the Ten Commandments. I made the point last week. Yes, it was a strict observance, and you'll see how strict in just a minute. And that strict observance can only be practiced if we read it in the Bible. God does not inspire us to know how the Jews worshipped in the Sabbath. He doesn't speak to us out of the sky. And if there's anybody that's going to say that, you know, this is the way that it should be practiced, either under the old law or as a Christian, you must find it in Scripture. That's what we'll be discussing in the debate. So last week, if you weren't here, we looked only at these three passages, a very lengthy one, Exodus 30 verses out of chapter 16, and then chapters 19 and most of 20, where we see the first two occurrences of that word Sabbath. And then we wrapped it up with a discussion from Hebrews chapter 12, verses 18 through 29, a lot of verses last week, you know, showing that what is discussed here and what we have now as Christians in the New Testament are very different. You have not come to that fiery and smoky and thunderous mountain. We have something very, very different. So new material for tonight is to see the next two places in Exodus where a Sabbath is mentioned. It is absolutely everything that we know about the Sabbath in the book of Exodus. It's in four places, the third of which is chapter 31, verses 12 through 18. So, turning there, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "As for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, you shall surely observe my Sabbaths." And please note here, it is plural. "For this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you." Why were they given the Sabbath? "That you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. Therefore, you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it," this is what you call a strict observance, "shall surely be put to death. Or whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from his people. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath, to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations, as," and this likely will be an argument the Seventh-day Adventists would make, "a perpetual thing." Perpetual calls up to our minds, you know, eternally or unceasingly, without end, a perpetual covenant. Adventists have been famous in the past. We'll see if this argument is floated in the debate. You know, have argued that since the Sabbath is identified as a perpetual covenant, then it cannot be set aside, abrogated, or in any way done away by the events of the cross and God's imposing a new covenant. If it's a perpetual covenant, then it cannot ever cease. This is an argument they've made often in the past. I rather doubt that Kent, a good friend of mine, will argue this way. He spent too much time with me, you know, to begin with. He spent 3 years talking about this. I have shown him the passages where many other things in Scripture are also described as perpetual. The priesthood is perpetual. The Day of Atonement is perpetual. The sacrifices were perpetual. This identical word is used about things that every Seventh-day Adventist argues vigorously has been done away. So, that argument on perpetual, they know full well, won't fly. Some of their people, their defenders, you know, in the past have used that. I wouldn't expect it out of Kent. I'll be surprised if he does that. He knows that that word does not mean eternal. It means age-lasting, or lasting as long as God says it will. And in this case, it is a perpetual covenant. We'll come back to that term in later passages in a moment. So, in 16, the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. There are no generations of Jews today, regardless of what the news might say, regardless of what the people who self-proclaim themselves to be Jews might say. One cannot be a Jew by biblical definition unless they can demonstrate, they can prove, they know, because they have an unbroken genealogical record, that they are direct descendants of Abraham. No human being has been able to do that for 2,000 years. As I've mentioned so many other times, one of the great joys of my life is meeting people who say they are Jews, to which I'll immediately say, oh, what tribe are you from? If you're a Jew, then you've got to be in a tribe. And you have to know what that tribe is. To claim that you're a Jew without having a tribal association is just as reasonable as my saying, I'm a Jew. Well, why? Because I say so. Because my parents say so. Because, you know, that's what I think. Well, fine. But the only definition that the Bible uses is direct descendant of Abraham. So, it was to be a perpetual covenant, brethren. It was to be a perpetual covenant throughout generations, which ended 2,000 years ago. 17. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. And again, we've had that perpetual and forever discussion. In 6 days, the Lord made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day, he ceased from labor and was refreshed. When he had finished speaking with him upon Mount Sinai, he gave Moses the 2 tablets of the testimony, tablets of stone, written by the finger of God. So the 10 commandments. What do we learn? We learn that if you're going to keep the Sabbath, then God has to tell you how to keep the Sabbath. When he tells them how to keep the Sabbath, do no work on this day, he also tells them what the penalty is for violation. Beyond all doubt, Kent will try to argue that you need to go down this verse and strip out the penalty and take that away. We're not going to have that anymore, but we still have to keep it. We now have to keep it without penalty. Which is not much of a keeping, is it, after all? And so they are intent on trying to make a division in God's discussions of his old covenants so that they can sweep away a part that is very odious and nobody would want to participate in, and then still claim, though, that they are keeping the Sabbath. Don't think so. Well, that's what that thought developed a little further as we come now to chapter 35. Go ahead and turn, Carol, yes. Yeah, exactly. How do you define this thing now? Okay? And back in those days, they had not only that written word, but of course they had living prophets to whom they could go. Moses is one of them, as we'll see a bit later in this lesson. And, you know, and ask, how do we handle this? How do we do this? So, Jews today, famous for that kind of thing. It's really interesting when you go to Israel. On Saturdays, the elevators in the hotel are programmed so that they have to stop at every floor. And I never did understand what the thinking was, but it's in order to keep the Sabbath somehow. I don't know if Donna remembers either now what it was, but it was just the oddest thing. And so they have Gentile elevators and Jewish elevators, And if you get in a Jewish elevator, you know, in a tall building on Saturdays in Israel, it takes a while. It has to stop at every floor, or it's considered a violation of the Sabbath somehow. Carol's talking about keys to the lock. You know, how do you define work? It is impossible to define that today. We couldn't, because the New Testament's never told us how. More on that, you know, to come. So, thank you for that, Carol. And now in chapter 35, verse 1, Moses assembled all the congregation of the sons of Israel and said to them, "These are the things that the Lord has commanded you to do. For 6 days, work may be done. On the seventh day, you shall have a holy day, a Sabbath of complete rest to the Lord. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. You shall not kindle a fire in any of your dwellings on the Sabbath day." Now again, we are given another element now of how to keep the Sabbath. You will do no work. And therefore, this will go directly to Carol's question, one of those works you cannot perform is the building of a fire, the kindling of a fire. So apparently you couldn't do much work at all. Donna and I lived in a house that we built ourselves in 1984 for 23 years. Our only source of heat was a wood stove. So I'm telling you, if I couldn't kindle a fire on Saturdays in the winter, I would have been soaking that thing pretty full on Friday night, you know, damping it down pretty low, and then, you know, maybe having to drag a sleeping bag out in the living room because, you know, it would be uncomfortable. So the requirements of keeping the Sabbath were pretty dramatic. They imposed on people's lives. It was not easy to do. It had your full attention. And particularly because if you kindle a fire on that day, what should be done to you? You should be put to death. God was serious about the Sabbath when he first spoke of it. Seventh-day Adventists seem to think, they believe reasonably, I don't, but they do, that God doesn't think so highly of the Sabbath anymore. He's done away with the death penalty entirely. We'll have to ask Kent how he feels about wood stoves. Now, that's it in Exodus. So far, that's also it in Genesis. Genesis never commands a Sabbath, never demonstrates any human being keeping one, is absolutely void of any reference to the Sabbath. Kent will maintain that from Adam on, the people were keeping the Sabbath. They had to, you know, God required it. But he can't find it in Genesis. That is an assumption. That is a presupposition. It is utterly without biblical foundation. And there's only four times in the whole book of Exodus where it's discussed, and you've just seen all four of them in the last two nights. Leviticus, though, has got a lot to say about it. So let's come on over to the next book, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus. Leviticus, named after Levi, is the priestly book. It is a book that is just chock full of how to be a Jew and how that religion is to function, how it is to be overseen by the Levites, and what you are to do about violations of that law. So, here's a book designed for those who were charged with the responsibility of making the Jews behave properly in God's covenant. And the first time we hear of it, the Sabbath, is in Leviticus, chapter 16, and starting at verse 29. "This shall be a permanent statute for you. In the seventh month, on the tenth day of the month, you shall humble your souls and not do any work, whether the native or the alien who sojourns among you. It is on this day that atonement shall be made for you to cleanse you. You shall be clean from all your sins before the Lord. It is to be a Sabbath of solemn rest for you, that you may humble your souls. It is a permanent statute." And there's that permanent statute again, which no Seventh-day Adventist will observe today. They think somehow that had to go away, but the weekly Sabbath stayed. This is still a Sabbath. It is a higher Sabbath than a weekly Sabbath. It's only one day out of the year. It is a Sabbath that is the day for which sin is atoned. It is the most important day of the year. It is the only day that a high priest or anybody else can go into the Holy of Holies. It is the only time that Jews were commanded to fast. They couldn't eat on that day either. And it is a Sabbath. And by the way, it falls on a different day every year. Okay? It doesn't fall on Saturdays. Sabbath and Saturday are not necessarily inseparable. A Sabbath is a rest. It's a day of rest. It could fall on any day of the week on the highest, holiest, most important Sabbath that there ever was, the Day of Atonement, which Sabbath the Jews believe has been done away for a lesser weekly Sabbath. You know, they had no reference to freedom from sin, you know, at all. Now, let's come to Leviticus chapter 19. These are shorter passages. So in Leviticus chapter 19, in the first three verses, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to all the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. Every one of you shall reverence his mother and his father, and you shall keep my Sabbaths. I am the Lord your God." Now, if you look at the next verses, you'll see additional commands from the Ten Commandments and outside the Ten Commandments are all put together in the same context. But there is, you know, just a command, keep the Sabbath. And then you'll find it again later in that chapter at verse 30. "You shall keep my Sabbath and revere my sanctuary. I am the Lord." So the Lord kept repeating this command, though not adding anything, you know, at that location. So let's turn a few pages and look now at a long series of verses where it comes up again and again and again in chapter 23, 24, 25, and 26. Won't read all of it, but let's start with the first 16 verses. We will get every verse that mentions the Sabbath. 23:1, the Lord spoke again to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel. Say to them, the Lord's appointed times which you shall proclaim as holy convocations. My appointed times are these." Verse 3, number 1. "For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest, a holy convocation. You shall not do any work. It is the Sabbath of the Lord in all your dwellings. These are the appointed times of the Lord, holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the times appointed for them. In the first month, on the 14th day of the month, at twilight, is the Lord's Passover." Now, I suggest you do as I have done. Mark these verses somehow, so that at least in verse 3, you know, circle seventh day and then a Sabbath. So now you know that's the weekly one. Then, at the end of verse 5, circle, for instance, or highlight somehow, the word Passover. Now we're going to find out about the Passover, which is one of those holy convocations. Verse 6, "On the 15th day of the same month, there is the Feast of Unleavened Bread." Circle unleavened bread. "For 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall have a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work. But for 7 days you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the seventh day is a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work." Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land which I am going to give to you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring in the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest." Circle first fruits. Here's your feast of the first fruits, the harvest, which I forgot to do in my own Bible, so get it there. In verse 11, "He shall weigh the sheaf before the Lord for you to be accepted. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall weigh it." Let's skip on down now to verses 15 and 16. "You shall also count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day when you brought in the sheaf of the wave offering. There shall be 7 complete Sabbaths. You shall count 50 days to the day after the seventh Sabbath. Then you shall present a new grain offering to the Lord." 50 days. So what feast is that? That's Pentecost. So famous because of Acts chapter 2. Now, you've just been given the weekly Sabbath in verse 3, the Passover in verses 3 and 4, or 5, I guess it is, and following, and the unleavened bread in 6, harvest in 10, or first fruits, and Pentecost in 15. Now, 21. On this same day you shall make a proclamation as well. You are to have a holy convocation. You shall do no laborious work. It is to be a perpetual statute in all your dwelling places throughout your generations. Brethren, that's the Pentecost. Perpetual. Whenever they try to argue, perpetual means it can't be done away in Christ, and Christians have to do it. They want that for perpetual Sabbath. They don't want it with perpetual anything else. That's a mistake. Sometimes consciously hypocritical, sometimes just in ignorance. It is sad and pathetic, and our responsibility to help do something about it when we meet people who don't know these things. But perpetual certainly doesn't mean that you and I have to do it. Now, skipping down to 24. Speak to the sons of Israel, saying, in the seventh month, on the first of the month, you shall have a rest, a reminder by blowing of the trumpet, a holy convocation. You shall not do any laborious work, but you shall present an offering by fire to the Lord. 27. On exactly the tenth day of this seventh month is the Day of Atonement. It shall be a holy convocation for you. You shall humble your souls and present an offering by fire to the Lord. Neither shall you do any work on this same day, for it is a Day of Atonement, to make atonement on your behalf before the Lord your God. If there's any person who will not humble himself on this same day, he shall be cut off from his people. What does that mean? Executed. As for any person who does any work on this same day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall do no work at all. It is to be a perpetual statute throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. Now, brethren, if the no work at all is a perpetual statute, question. Look at the verses. 28, 29, 30, and 31. Where does it say keeping the Sabbath is a perpetual statute, but the penalty for breaking it isn't? Do you see any sort of separation in those verses? Does not the death penalty carry the same responsibilities that are found in that word perpetual? If the keeping of the Sabbath is perpetual, the punishment for breaking the Sabbath is perpetual. You can't separate them there. 32. It is to be a Sabbath of complete rest to you. You shall humble your souls on the ninth of the month at evening. From evening until evening, you shall keep your Sabbath. So, there is your Day of Atonement again. Now, on 34. On the 15th of this seventh month, the Feast of Booths. For 7 days to the Lord. On the first day of the Holy Convocation, you shall do no laborious work of any kind. 7 days you'll present an offering by fire to the Lord. On the eighth day you shall have a Holy Convocation and present an offering by fire to the Lord. It is an assembly. You shall do no laborious work. These are the appointed times of the Lord, which you shall proclaim as holy convocations, to present offerings by fire to the Lord. Burnt offerings and grain offerings, sacrifices and libations, each day's matter on its own day. Besides those of the Sabbath of the Lord, there's your weekly Sabbath now, and besides your gifts and besides all your votive and freewill offerings which you give to the Lord. So at this point, brethren, I know a lot of reading, but all I'm going to say is this. Whatever's perpetual, if the Adventist is right, must be observed by Christians. That now has included the Day of Atonement, the Passover, the Pentecost, Feast of Booths, all of them. And on those things which are perpetual, there are animal sacrifices that must be offered. On some of them, assemblies are required. On others, they are not. But the death penalty is imposed for every one of them. So, when a Sabbatarian tries to wander down through there, cherry-picking what he wants and doesn't, for whatever reason he might give, the Bible gives no such excuse. The Bible gives no such separation. The Bible gives no such reason to do so. Okay, that'll bring us to verses, I guess I already read those and I forgot about it. Okay, so chapter 24 now. Come to 24 and skip on down to verse 1 and 2 to get the setting. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the sons of Israel, they bring to you clear oil from beaten olives for the light to make a lamp burn, what? Continually. Okay, so now, verse 8, every Sabbath day he shall set it in order before the Lord continually. It is an everlasting covenant for the sons of Israel. I ask you, how many Jews have a menorah burning in the temple or anywhere else when they keep the Sabbath? They don't. Why? It is a continual and perpetual everlasting covenant. Why not? Because they know that that means only as long as there are Jews and the Jewish law, almost all the time. They make only one exception. They make it for the Sabbath. They should not. Chapter 25, verses 1 through 8. The Lord then spoke to Moses at Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I shall give you, then the land shall have a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather in its crop. But during the seventh year the land shall have a Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall not sow your field nor prune your vineyard. Your harvests after growth you shall not reap. Your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. And all of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food. Yourself, your male and female slaves, your hired man, your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you, even your cattle and the animals that are in your land shall have all its crops to eat. You are also to count off 7 Sabbaths of years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, so that you have the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years, namely 49 years. And then, and we're not going to discuss that tonight, but there's a 50th year. What's your 50th year? Jubilee. See? So now, you can't harvest, you can't plow, plant, you can't weed for a year. Your animals do no work. You live off what you can just glean out of the fields growing wild, or what you may have stored up in the previous year, like they did with the manna on a weekly basis in the wilderness. Does any Sabbatarian practice any of those Sabbaths today? No. You'll get to hear their reasoning why. It will not come from the Bible. The Bible does not make the distinctions that they make. It does not then allow certain parts of the Sabbath to be done away and others are not. But you'll also observe, brethren, I think, I hope you'll just recognize as you're reading this, do you see how these requirements are imposed on a nation in a given geographical area which they control? We cannot keep the Sabbath in America today. Why? Because America is not a theocracy. We couldn't, if we wanted to, say no farmer can plant under penalty of debt. All debts must be forgiven every 50 years. What bank would go for that? Okay? We cannot do this, nor can any other nation, nor can the Jews, for that matter. They don't have a temple in which to offer sacrifices and do the Day of Atonement. And so, all of those, as you're looking around the edges, you realize this is for a specific people in a specific place over which they have complete control. And it's a death penalty if you violate it. That is the law of the land. Okay? All such ideas of a physical territory that belongs to God and a race of people that belongs to God was done away in the cross. With it, necessarily, our Sabbath, their Sabbath, as well. And the last one in Leviticus is chapter 26. Leviticus, of course, says the most about it. Got a few verses there. So Leviticus 26, let's start with 33. You, however, I will scatter among the nations and will draw out a sword after you as your land becomes desolate and your cities become waste. Now, if you were to go back, the setting for this is in verses 14 and 15 and 16. I'm not going to read them, but if you break my Sabbath, if you don't keep my commandments,
then I'll lay waste your cities. So in 34, then the land will enjoy its Sabbaths all the days of the desolation while you are in your enemy's land. Then the land will rest and enjoy its Sabbath all the days of its desolation. It will observe the rest, which it did not observe on your Sabbath while you were living on it. You will lose your land if you don't keep the Sabbaths. They are holy convocations. They are all set equally. They are none of them, the Lord says, to be done away. They are perpetual statutes. None to be done away for how long or for whom? Throughout your generations. There is no longer a physical people, a chosen people of God, physically. 43, the land shall be abandoned by them and shall make up for a Sabbath while it is made desolate without them, and thus closes every appearance of the Sabbath in the book of Leviticus. And when you get done looking at it as biblical immigrants, biblical students, buried in all the material that says anything about the Sabbath, when you get all the data, you find out it's for a particular people at a particular time in a particular place under a particular law which has been done away. And the Sabbaths are not separated from one another as some to be canceled and others not. Now, I am short on time, so let me put these up for you note takers. And we'll probably come back to this again next week, the tail end. But here are, in the book of Moses, who ought to know what he's talking about when it comes to commandments and Sabbaths, the last remaining places in his five books where you can find any reference to a Sabbath. Numbers comes up first. Numbers chapter 15, 32 through 36. While the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Sabbath. Those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation. They put him in custody because it had not been declared what should be done to him. Then the Lord said to Moses, "The man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp." So all the congregation brought him outside the camp, stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moses. This is a national responsibility. Any violator of the Sabbath today in America, if the Adventist is right, should be put to death. You and I have long since vanished from the earth. Okay. If we don't keep the Sabbath, we're not about to start. There's no biblical reason to do so. But the Lord was pretty insistent about it back then. So they had the first test case. Now turning 13 chapters in Numbers to chapter 28 and the first three verses. Lord spoke to Moses saying, "Command the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be careful to present my offerings, my food for my offerings by fire, of the soothing aroma to me at their appointed times. And you shall say to them, this is the offering by fire which you shall offer to the Lord. Two male lambs, 1 year old, without defect, as a continual burnt offering every day." Okay, so that's going on. Now skip to 9. "Then, on the Sabbath day, two male lambs, 1 year old, without defect. 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil as a grain offering and its libation. This is the burnt offering of every Sabbath in addition to the continual burnt offering and its libation." Will any Seventh-day Adventist defend his responsibility to obey that verse? No, they will not. They have decided to do away with it. I've got just a minute. Let's go ahead and see this last one in Deuteronomy 5. And we will begin there next week, as it is a very prominent and pivotally important passage in this regard. Moses is going to give the speak of the Ten Commandments again in this passage. So verses 1 through 3, Moses summoned all Israel, said to them, "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and the ordinances which I am speaking today in your hearing, that you may learn them and observe them carefully. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. The Lord did not make this covenant with our fathers, but with us, all those of us alive here today." Now you see how significant that is. Adventist maintains it had been done ever since Adam and Eve. The Bible says it has not It's just starting. They didn't have the covenant with the Sabbath in it prior to that time. Verse 12. Observe the Sabbath day to keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. 7th day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work. You, your son or your daughter, or your male servant, your female servant, your ox, your donkey, and any of your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you, so that your male servant and your female servant may rest as well as you. And you shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. And I want every one of you now to do that. Remember how you were a slave in Egypt? Kind of tough, isn't it? And the Lord your God brought you out of there by a mighty hand and by an outstretched arm. Therefore, what does the therefore? The Lord your God commanded you to observe the Sabbath. If anybody were to say to you, why were the Jews commanded to keep the Sabbath? What would your answer be? Because he took them out of Egypt. Therefore, he gave them the Sabbath. That verse 15 is important. Thank you. I know this is a lot of meat. Okay? Helps me if not you. We'll keep doing this for another couple of weeks. But this is the whole story, brethren, from which we will call the ideas that will actually be presented.